this is going to be a very personal sermon, not terribly intellectual. I want to talk about my spiritual journey on the issue of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender issues. I was born in America in 1944. I was raised to be a good practicing homophobe. That's what I was trained to be. Incidentally, a lot of my gay friends were also raised to be homophobes because that was the state of teaching. We were supposed to be afraid of the other. We were supposed to be so secure about ourselves that any hint of insecurity would be absolutely devastating. I was a product of my raising. And so I told fag jokes. I didn't know what the word fag meant, but I told fag jokes. I knew that it meant somehow the other, the different. Someone who would be picked on, who would be teased, who would be marginalized, who would not be accepted within the circle of the real guys. But I didn't know what in the world it was. But it didn't stop me from being crude and vulgar and condescending. It didn't stop me from wanting to protect myself from being accused of being one of them, whoever they were. And I really didn't know. I had no idea. As I learned, I realized, oh, okay, well, I was raised to be a homophobe, but when you really think about it, I was also raised to be a heterophobe. Because when you think about sex acts, yours, someone else's, and God help us, either our parents or our children, it does not fall into gay and non-gay. It falls into people do that? You can't be serious. My mommy? I don't think so. Even today, on the heterosexual side of things, how can I put this? When our kids visit, they feel a certain chilling effect of having their parents in the next room to their evening recreational activities. Their parents feel exactly the same way. One of the things when people think about gayness is they go, ugh, because they're thinking about stuff that they go, ugh, about anyway. I had a couple of epiphanies on my journey from being an out-of-the-closet homophobe towards mediating it, remediating it. One of them was an epiphany when I was 15 years old. I was with my girlfriend at Pacific Ocean Park, and I saw two lesbians together. A very early version of gaydar, 1950s version of gaydar. And I made some kind of inappropriate, hurtful, judgmental comment. And my girlfriend said, what do you care? What is it to you? Why do you need to look at it, to judge it, to characterize it, to caricature it? These are just two people. What do their lives together have to do with you? At that point, I knew my girlfriend was a lot smarter and more mature than I was. And it was a beginning, not an end, a beginning of a journey away from my carefully learned homophobia. Because the so what is a very nice mantra to have. So what? They love each other. They're with each other. Do I care what they do out of my sight? No. Do I care what people do in my sight towards other human beings? Absolutely. But why would their sexual orientation be any of my business. I still did fag jokes. When I was working as a comedian in the 1960s, I have to say with some shame that I did some of those stories. And I didn't know. I honestly thought, well, you know, these are just stories. They're caricatures. They're stereotypes. How is my doing a gay voice different from Myron Cohen doing a Jewish accent and telling stories about Jewish people? Well, the answer to that question was Myron Cohen was Jewish. I was not gay. It wasn't okay. I didn't know how much it hurt, how much it demeaned, how much it marginalized people that I had no argument with. I'm getting a message. It really, the so what really became my mantra. I had a bunch of experiences that helped transform me from the kind of normal neurotic to an abnormal neurotic, I guess, because you don't get over phobias and fears just all of a sudden. It's an evolutionary process of learning where I had to continue to repeat, so what? I remember in my previous congregation sitting at a bar with a congregant who was gay, and we were waiting for a third friend, and I'm sitting at this bar in Studio City going, are people going to think I'm gay? I had that little, you know, junior high school thing, and I was already a grown-up kind of minister. And then I said, oh, so what? So somebody thinks I'm gay. Is that insulting? Why should it be insulting? I knew that I was supposed to be insulted back in elementary school and junior high school and maybe high school, but why in the world would I feel insulted by that now? One of the things that I remembered is I was working a club in San Francisco called Coffee and Confusion, and most of the staff was gay, and I actually don't remember whether that word was a term of art back then, and they used to play and flirt. And it wasn't threatening. There was no, I know people that got mad if they thought they were being cruised or someone was coming on, but when you have choices, what are you being mad about? So this one person was saying, you know, come on home with me. And I said, I don't think so. He said, well, how do you know if you haven't tried? And I said, you know, I haven't jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, but I'm pretty sure. And he said, but the greatest people, now this is not argumentation, this is playing. He said, but the greatest minds in the world, Plato and Michelangelo, were gay. And I said, so if I go home with you, I'm going to think like Plato and paint like Michelangelo? He said, God, yes. And, you know, that's fun. There's not a threat in here. There's nothing that is erasing who I am. These are people having fun with each other. A couple of years ago, and I know this is a cliche, I was at the YMCA swimming and I got cruised, and it was really kind of, and the homophobe didn't come out. The yenta came out because the young man basically asked if I wanted a back rub, and which I could have taken as an affront, but didn't. And I just looked at her and said, I'm a fat old breeder. You can do so much better. In fact, my cousin Sam, I think you're really his type. You know, I tried to fix him up. We have choices about how we respond to things. And just because we may have responded when we were in junior high school or high school one way because that's how we were taught, when you get to the so what, we're talking about people. People looking for each other, people finding each other, and when there's no force and no coercion, as in all other matters sexual, what is the interest of someone else? One of the things that was really important was actually in my ministerial training. We had a course in Berkeley in 1970 on dealing with homophobia. And it was taught by a by an unsettled gay Unitarian Universalist minister, and it was basically confront your fears. And we saw pictures and we saw films, and after a while it was, okay, so what? It's the way people act out their sexuality. And when they're consenting adults, I should not have a problem. In my first church in 1970, a woman came to me and said, I'd like you to perform a marriage service for me. And I said, well, you know, it's not legally a marriage, but it never occurred to me to say no. It never occurred to me to think, you know, there's just too much love in the world. We shouldn't recognize anymore. There are just too many happy families. We shouldn't put any more together. That never occurred to me. I have to admit the revenue stream did occur to me, but that's another issue. So I did this service in 1970, and I got absolutely no static from my congregation. And in Studio City, I got absolutely no static from my congregation. And so far, nobody here has said anything negative to me about performing same-sex unions. And I do love Robin Williams' line, which is, if you're married, it's always same-sex. But that's... Robin Williams said that. I didn't say that. The ceiling's not going to fall down. What's our problem? What is our problem with this? When you look at where sexual mores come from religiously, they come from procreation being conception efficient. So that fun and having a good time is only the lost leader to get you to procreate. And it didn't take our ancient ancestors too long to figure out that that gay sex was not conception efficient. That the children just didn't... Well, my friends Herb and Ski, I know I've told this story in my previous congregation again. Herb and Ski were together 46 years before Ski passed away. And they raised two perfectly horrible children. But that wasn't because it was the children. Believe me, it was the children. Anyway, a friend of mine said, you know, they've done such a wonderful job with the kids. Are they adopted? And I just went, yeah. And of course, now, I have to say, of course they could have had from previous relationships. So I went to Herb, and I said, Herb, you know, Walter said, asked if you adopted the kids. He said, you know, we tried for years, but finally we had to adopt. There was nothing wrong with that picture. There was nothing that occurred to me that might be wrong with that picture. We look at the sexual mores and laws of religion, and we say, well, all this stuff is bad. All this stuff is bad because it doesn't lead to producing children. Is that the very most important thing that we need with the population growth on this planet? I mean, at this point, it should be a sacrament, not a sin. And someday, I hope it will be. When I finally got to do an out-of-the-closet legal marriage ceremony between the first one was between two women, I was unprofessionally thrilled. I was just over the top because I literally never thought that we would get this far within my lifetime. The journey from my elementary school to legalized marriage was such a hallelujah moment for me that I was shouting it above the roar of the waves down in Laguna Beach where I did the service. That window has closed now is very sad and very frustrating, but it will open again. This is a war whose outcome is certain. Now, there are a lot of people that get very excited when the comparisons get involved. For example, Jennifer talking about the Israelites and black liberation and gay equal rights. Well, it's not the same. It's not the same. Nothing is exactly the same as anything else. It's true. The Jewish experience was different from the African American experience, which is different from the gay experience. What they have in common is oppression is oppression. Being marginalized, being teased, being taunted, being sent away, being rolled and mugged and lynched and beaten is the common thread and the common denominator. And right now, as our country and our society deals with this issue, there are a lot of people who are making the political statement, which is too much, too soon, it's not the right time. That's what politicians say. It's not the right time. It's not the perfect time. It's never the perfect time. What Martin Luther King said is it is always time to do the right thing, to see the humanity, end quote, to see the humanity in others, to affirm the humanity in others, to find love and not snuff it out, but fan the flames until it is something that is warming and illuminating. It's always the right time to do the right thing. Now, if you don't think it's the right thing, that's a different issue. But if it's the political part, it's the right time to do the right thing. Not tomorrow, not 6 months from tomorrow, not in 5 years when the people are ready. The people never would have been ready to integrate without the civil rights movement. The people would never be willing to do many of the things that have happened because there were activists who said, we want equality of opportunity. We don't want special rights. We want equality of opportunity. We don't want to be hated. We don't want to be lynched. We don't want to be marginalized. We want people to see our humanity and not simply our sexual orientation. The right time. Rabbi Hillel said, if not now, when?